Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Deborah Becker, in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Today is the last day of campaigning in France for this Sunday's referendum on whether French citizens will approve a European Union constitution and bring the continent another step closer to the United States of Europe. Last night, President Jacques Chirac went on French television to plead with voters to support the constitution, but public opinion surveys say most French citizens will vote no. It's being called a political earthquake in France, and joining us to talk about this is Pierre Briancone. He's Paris bureau chief for the Dow Jones Newswires. Welcome, Pierre.
Hello, how are you?
Hello. France, along with Germany, has always seemed the most enthusiastic about creating a united Europe, and it's my understanding that France helped write the Constitution. What's the problem now?
Well, the problem is that the vote on Sunday will be on anything but European construction. Europe has been used as a scapegoat by most political leaders for the last 10 or 15 years now. Scapegoat in terms of it was Europe that pushed for reforms that the French were reluctant to implement. And on top of that, the current administration of President Jacques Chirac and his Prime Minister Jean-Pierre Raffarin are at the lowest a government has been in ever in terms of unpopularity. So a lot of frustration will probably congregate on that day, and a lot of the no vote will have nothing to do with the actual treaty that is proposed to the referendum.
So really it's a referendum on the government.
As all referendum throughout French history, they've always been used by people to express their support or their disgust, if you want, towards the ruling administration. This is no exception. It has been that way for a long, long time.
Mm-hmm. What about other European countries? They're apparently the Prime Minister of Spain, yes, and the German Chancellor have been in France campaigning for the Constitution. How is it doing in other countries?
Well, most of the major big European countries have voted or have expressed their support for the current treaty. This is the case with Germany. This is the case with Spain and the case with Italy. The Dutch, which is, of course, a smaller country in the European balance, have a referendum next week as well. The Danes will have one. But most major countries have supported the treaty. And, of course, all throughout Europe, there's kind of a fear that the lack of support by France will throw all the tough work that has been done over the last years on the treaty down the river.
How many countries are needed to for it to be adopted?
All countries have to adopt it. If one country says no, then the whole thing has to be started over again. Of course, there's strong doubt that it would ever be started over again.
Mm-hmm. Can French voters take it up again then?
Theoretically, it's not impossible. Legally, it's possible, but politically, one cannot see how Chirac could come back a few months from now, because it would have to be the same text.
It's being called a treaty and a constitution. Why is that?
Well, it's a treaty because it's an agreement between different sovereign countries. And it's a constitution because it sets the rules by which the European Union will be governed. One has to remember that the main reason for that endeavor was that you do not rule or manage or govern Europe with 10 or 15 countries the same way you do with 25 countries.
Mm-hmm.
And the fear that a 25-country Europe could be paralyzed by the current rules is what's at the heart of the treaty.
Is the Constitution a beautifully written document, do you think? Many people, when they think of the U.S. Constitution, they call it a beautifully written Constitution. Is that the case?
Oh, not at all. In a certain way, I mean, according to the Western political tradition and history, even calling it a constitution is probably a misnomer because it's 400 pages long. I mean, there are lots of articles. Again, first of all, it's a compromise. So 25 countries had to have, you know, something to feel good about. Second, it's a compromise because unavoidably it's complicated. And third, they thought it would be a good idea to add to the treated with all the former treaties that laid the ground for European Union. So altogether, it's not the beautifully written 20 or 25 articles constitution the Western world is used to.
Pierre Briancone, Paris Bureau Chief for the Dow Jones Newswires, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
This week, Amnesty International singled out the government of Sudan as one of the world's worst human rights abusers, accusing it of turning its back as government forces and allied militias attacked people in the Darfur region. One man with a unique perspective on the alleged abuses in Sudan is 47-year-old Hartford Current newspaper photographer Bradley Clift. Last month, he traveled to refugee camps in Darfur with a Sudanese Catholic Relief Agency to document the humanitarian crisis there. But within days, he was arrested and detained for 16 days before he was finally released. Bradley Clift joins us from the studios of member station WNPR in Hartford, Connecticut. Welcome.
Thank you, Deborah. It's good to be here. Back in Connecticut.
I can imagine. This is the first time you're really telling your story. I understand that it was so horrific that you sought post-traumatic stress counseling. Are you doing all right?
Yeah, I'm doing fine. There's some good people here who are working with me to try to, you know, reassimilate back into life in Connecticut and the United States.
Mm-hmm. And tell us about your trip. When did you go and why? And how many days were you there before you were arrested?
Well, you start in Khartoum, and I was there for 3 days waiting for paperwork to clear so that I could move on to Niala, which is the center of Darfur, and began my work there. And after 2 days in Darfur, I was grabbed in a camp that you just weren't supposed to be in and weren't supposed to be photographing in without explicit written permission, which they don't give. So I was in a place that I wanted to be both to try to help with my photographs through the Catholic Church and other charities in the country that was trying to raise awareness of what's going on in Darfur through photographic documentation. And as a journalist, I would have sought further outlets for that work too, to try to not only galvanize some support for the aid workers who are trying to work there and help save people, but also to try to give more information to Americans who seem to be kind of in the dark about what's going on in Darfur. There's very few publications who are able to get there and get work done because of what the government is doing.
You spent $10,000 of your own money for this. You were with the Sudanese Catholic Relief Agency, and your newspaper did not send you. Why is that?
Well, I think that there's a couple of different reasons, and you could do a whole show on what's happening with journalism throughout the country as far as corporations kind of cutting back and trying to increase profits and thereby not covering as much or as wide as they used to. For me, I was dedicated to doing this work once I heard that there was not enough information coming out of Darfur, that it was in fact called genocide by Kofi Annan, Secretary General of the UN, and also by Colin Powell, former Secretary of State, as well as our own Congress. So if that wasn't enough evidence that evidence needed to be gathered, what made me most interested in it was that there are journalists I know who've been to certain regions, but there are other regions that were uncovered. And the only way to continually cover a story is to continually cover it, having as many journalists with as many points of view covering as many aspects of it as possible. I'd seen camp photos and I'd seen hospital photos, but I hadn't really seen a lot about what was actually happening in the villages. We were also being told by their government, which was being reinforced by our government, that the killing not only stopped, but the burning of the villages had stopped. And I knew from other people on the ground that that just wasn't true, and I intended to go show that. Yes, I did spend my own money to do it. I believed in it. I'd done it in Somalia. I've done it in China. I've done it in Romania. I've done it in a few other places where I believe – this is over a 25-year career. Mm-hmm. There are things I believe need to be done that newspapers sometimes can't support because of the size of their newspaper. The Current is very commendable in what they do with journalism for the size of paper it is, and it's very ambitious. But they have limited funds and limited – possibilities. So I decided this is something that was right up my alley. It's something I thought I could really do direct help with my photography. And I was willing to spend, yes, $10,000 of my own money and my own time to go do because I believed in it as basically a kind of an American reaching out to in a Muslim country, mostly Muslim country, Islamic country, that it's Muslims who are killing Muslims there. So,
and let's hear about what happened. You said that you went into a camp that you weren't supposed to be in. Can you tell me, were there any sort of warnings about this? Why did you decide to go there? And then what happened, what led to your arrest, basically?
There are over 100 camps in Darfur with an average of 20,000 per camp. That's about 2 million people. I think the Red Cross puts it at 2.1 million people. Some of them put it at 1.8 million who are in these camps. Now, the Janjaweed came in and they hit all these villages just like a human tidal wave.
Those folks who might not know, can you identify the Janjaweed?
The Janjaweed, that literally means the devil on horseback is how it translates. But it's basically these Arab Sudanese who believe that the African Sudanese are inferior, and so they were trying to rid them from the land that they're on. It is in dispute whose land that is. Darfur actually means the home of the Fur, and the Fur is the Fur tribe in Darfur, and that is about 75% African Sudanese, dark Africans, as opposed to the Arab African Sudanese, who are less dark. And it is an ethnic cleansing that is going on there. I mean, it is absolutely a race problem. It's not a religious problem. It's a race problem. So, because it's Muslim killing Muslim. And the Janjaweed are feared fighters who are fearless and have gone in and killed children and killed all the men in these villages and raped women. And it has swept the people into these camps, both towards the Chad border and east towards Niala and another place called El Fasher. And in these camps, the bigger camps are taken care of somewhat by the aid agencies, given shelter, given medicine, given food. That 1 million people are still at risk for starvation. The other 1 million in the smaller camps, the government won't allow them to go in and help them. So they're at huge risk. It's 100 degrees to 115 degrees right now in Niala and in the Darfur region. So this kind of heat in this kind of desert without food, without water, without medicine, puts them at huge risk. And the government will basically say, well, yeah, a million people died, but it wasn't our fault. It was just the elements, or it was just the lack of medicine or a lack of potable water. So it's a very good scheme and diabolical in its intent. So, and the Janjaweed, I think, are doing the bidding for the government. The government says it's a militia we can't control, and in fact, the government has actually supported through the air some of the campaigns against these villages. So it's a very a dark situation, and even medieval in some of its foreboding terror.
Bradley Clift is a photographer who was arrested and jailed for taking pictures in the Darfur region of Sudan. When we return, what he saw in the refugee camps. Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now. I'm Deborah Becker. It's Here and Now. We're continuing our conversation with Bradley Clift, a photojournalist who spent $10,000 of his own money to travel to refugee camps in the Darfur region of Sudan last month and document what aid agencies and the U.S. government call a genocide. Clift says he wanted to travel there because the humanitarian crisis is undercovered in the media, in large part because of government repression in Sudan. Bradley, tell us about your arrest. What were you charged with?
There were four charges levied against me. And mainly, I was in a camp I wasn't supposed to be in, which I knew. I mean, this was a camp that no one was supposed to be in. And they have people who are watching those camps. And they don't want photography of these camps because they are neglected. And it really is proof of what they're doing. Mm-hmm. And it is documentary proof of what they're doing. And as a result of that, they got me the second day. But the first day, I was already shooting in another camp called Kamla Camp. and shooting without escort, shooting without anybody's official permission, which is, from my point of view, what journalists are supposed to do. They're supposed to go outside of what the government tells you you can do. We're supposed to be separate from them. We're supposed to try to show what's happening rather than going into the clean and the cleanse camp and the one that everybody's being fed and serviced, and you want to go to the places where they don't want you to go and show what's really going on. And that was my intent. And,
I hate to interrupt you, but and part of that, I hear that some folks might think, well, then basically you were trying to prove a point. You wanted to go to the worst camp in the region to prove a point. Don't you think that could be problematic for a journalist?
Well, I think, you could say that. I mean, you could argue that. I think if you went to where the government always wanted you to go to, in any country, with the government, it's like you're doing public relations for the government. You're not doing journalism.
So what basically happened again? Now, you were charged with, being in a camp that you were not supposed to be in, and what were the other charges?
The first charge that was read to me in front of the police was you came to Sudan with the intent of hurting our reputation, which is basically being at war with Sudan. You took photographs with the intent of harming Sudan's reputation. That's two. And you entered Sudan and Niala illegally. And the simple charge of you took photographs without permission. And a chief of investigators said, the first two are executionable offenses, and we intend to prove them, and we intend to see you hang. And this is what he told me on May 5th, when most people back here, including the State Department, were saying, it's just a simple fine for taking pictures where he wasn't supposed to, so he'll just pay a fine and be freed.
What was it like in captivity?
In captivity, it was frightening. I had some people tell me that you should have an escape plan, there might be people coming for you in the middle of the night. This was people who had been in prison before. And another man, who I can't really name, pleaded eloquently for my release from the prison that I was in the first day, and they released me to this organization in which compound that I stayed. But it became published in Arab newspapers throughout their region, and people knew I was there, and it was being held under house arrest. So it became really a frightening situation because I knew just the tensions between, the Islamic world and our world were very high right now, and so we wanted to work hard and quickly to get me out of the situation because I stood up and said to this man, "Yes, I am. I mean, I'm here to try to help. Actually, to try to help these people." That people in your country have gravely injured and hurt, and you're trying to make me look like I'm the guilty party.
And but how do you think you got out in the end?
I don't know. I think there were many people. There was a colleague of mine, Tracy Fox, who's a reporter at the paper, who helped, and she was a go-between between the State Department and my family and friends and other journalists. There was Tom McGuire, the director of photography and assistant managing editor for photography, who was very helpful and instrumental in working 24 hours a day.
Even though the paper didn't support this trip, it was folks at the paper who were instrumental in lobbying on your behalf to get you out.
Absolutely. Of the hospital. Absolutely. They were 100% behind me once I got caught and once I was in peril.
We've put some of your photographs up on our website. Which one strikes a chord with you?
There's a photograph of a woman in Kamla camp who said that she walked there for several days, that none of her family was left, and that the things that happened to her were unspeakable, that they took the men and shot them, and the women, she wouldn't speak about what happened to them. And she just has this look on her face that she's just, her body's here on earth, but she's no longer spiritually with us.
Did you see genocide?
No, I did not ever get to the place where I needed to get to because I was stopped in my tracks trying to get there. And one of the things about the plan we made is they looked at my notes and they realized that I was going to the place that this was still happening and they had to stop me. So it wasn't just about taking photographs in that camp. They didn't want me to go further.
You said that you've been to several places around the world to take photographs like this. How does Darfur compare?
Well, I mean, one of the things about it that strikes you is that it is one of you could have shot in the one camp that I did, which was the best camp in Darfur, which is Kamla, which is the most taken care of, and it's also the biggest, which is the one they take everybody to because it's nice, but it's still extreme. So you can say that I went to the extreme of the extreme, but you could have just shot in that camp and that you would have been fine at telling the story. I think it's up to journalists to go a step further from what people are showing you and telling you and try to tell the complete story. That way, completeness is the truth, not incomplete or shallow reporting, but in-depth reporting, visual and verbally. And I think that's what needed to be done. That's what I attempted to do. And in trying to press a case against me, I think they proved the case against themselves. They have something to hide.
All right. Bradley, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Bradley Clift is a photographer for the Hartford Current newspaper in Connecticut. You can see some of his pictures from Darfur on our website, here-now.org. Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now. I'm Deborah Becker, in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. The stem cell research debate took another turn this week, with the U.S. Senate indicating that it may follow House lawmakers who voted to overturn President Bush's 4-year-old ban on federal funding for some of the research. The president is threatening his first-ever veto, and supporters are getting louder in saying that stem cells could help people suffering from dozens of diseases. To discuss some of the ethical issues involved, first, we're joined by Professor George Annis, a medical ethicist at the Boston University School of Public Health. Welcome.
Thank you.
Right now, there is some federal funding for stem cell research, but it's limited to certain lines. What do you think about this debate to expand federal funding for the research?
Well, it's limited to those lines that had been created prior to the president's speech on August 9th, 2001. And his reason for that was, he said, the life and death decision for these embryos has already been made. And so the president's position is that you should never either create an embryo to destroy it or destroy an existing embryo for the purpose of doing research on it. And I think that is not really a tenable position, because he immediately adds, people can do whatever they want to do in the private sector.
What we're talking about here, at least in terms of the House action, we are talking about embryos that would have been discarded anyway.
Well, we're talking about not creating embryos just for the purpose of research, but using embryos that had been created for the purpose of reproduction that couples no longer want to use for whatever reason in IVF clinics for reproduction any longer. What should be done with those? Is it acceptable to keep them frozen, or instead of doing that, either to destroy them or use them for research? And most people believe it's a reasonable political, if not a moral, decision to say that if you're going to destroy them, it's at least as good, if not better, to permit them to be used for research.
The president has a council on bioethics to look at the ideas to conduct stem cell research in a way that would be, I think they say, ethically uncontroversial. Do you think that's possible?
No, actually, I think that's silly. I mean, that council was created in order to come up with an ethical rationale for the president's initial position that there should be no federal funding to create any additional embryonic stem cell lines. And the council was unable to do that. It couldn't really figure out any moral reason why it was okay for the private sector to engage in this research, but not okay for the federal government to fund it. So they've now changed tactics and tried to come up with alternate ways to get stem cells instead of from human embryos, and to come up with some technical fix, if you will, for this ethical problem. And I don't think you can fix an ethical problem with technological shenanigans, basically.
Yeah. So one of the proposals that appears to be gaining support is the one from Stanford University researcher Dr. William Hurlbut, and we're actually going to be speaking with him on the program today. And his proposal would change adult DNA so that the cells apparently never develop into what's being called a true embryo. What do you think are some of the ethical issues involved?
Well, I actually think that is not gaining support. He's really about the only one who supports it. His the President's Council, which he's a member of, issued a report just a couple of weeks ago, a white paper on these various technologies. And of his specific one, they wrote that because this proposal raises many serious ethical concerns, we do not believe it is at this time ethically acceptable. So even the council that he's a member of thinks this is not ethically acceptable. Many on the council worry that if it is ethically acceptable to create something that can't become an embryo, that same logic could be said, well, it's also then ethically acceptable to create something that couldn't become a full-term baby. And maybe you could create a fetus that would die or degenerate at 6 or 7 months and then use its liver or its heart. I mean, it's just kind of a Frankensteinian type of approach.
Professor Annis, thanks very much for speaking with us.
Sure. Good to talk to you.
George Annis is a medical ethicist at the Boston University School of Public Health. We now turn to Dr. William Hurlbut of the Program in Human Biology at Stanford University. He is a member of the President's Council on Bioethics. Welcome.
Thank you.
Dr. Hurlbut, I'd like you to react to some of the criticism from Professor Annis. He called your proposal a technical fix and Frankensteinian.
Yeah, I don't think he kind of gets the point, and he misrepresented the council report also. We said it was acceptable to do in animal studies to see exactly what happens, and if it comes out the way I believe it will, then it would be acceptable to use in humans. The controversy, of course, is that living embryos are created to be disaggregated and destroyed to get the embryonic stem cells. In nuclear transfer, which is what the Koreans did last week, in that technique, what's done is a human egg has its nucleus removed, and that nucleus is replaced by the nucleus of an adult cell. This is then activated, and it becomes, in some cases, the equivalent of a fertilized egg and goes on to develop. If Dolly was a sheep, then the cloned embryo of Dolly was once a sheep embryo. The similar project would be done with altered nuclear transfer, but a difference would be present, and that would be that the nucleus of the adult cell would be altered before being transferred in such a way that it was not capable of organizing in such a way that it formed a human embryo. It would just be something more like a tissue culture. It is not at all ghoulish. It's simply a difference of gene expression patterns such that it was not capable of organizing like an embryo.
But maybe not an embryo, but a mutant human being?
No, not at all. It's not a being at all.
Well, what is it?
It's a biological product. It's like an artifact. We've actually got a way to do this now that is even less controversial in that it changes just gene expression patterns so that it can't organize.
Mm-hmm. So how would you describe support for it?
The current proposal has very broad support among Catholic moral philosophers, including the head of the Department of Philosophy at the Gregorian University in Rome, including an archbishop, including major Catholic moral philosophers and Protestant moral philosophers, and just general scientists and commentators. And the main point here is that there are ways to do this. You know, I agree with Professor Annis. In a sense, you can't just fix an ethical problem with a technological solution, but you can bypass the ethical problem. If we can't agree on when an embryo has moral standing, we could agree perhaps on what isn't an embryo, what isn't controversial to use instrumentally.
The proposal in Congress asks for only the use of embryos that would be discarded from fertility clinics anyway. Where do you stand on that?
You know, in working in the President's Council, I didn't come in with my mind made up on this. The Council may have been created by the President, but it was not created purely as a rubber stamp kind of approval for what he thought. I didn't have my mind completely made up. If you understand the science of modern knowledge of embryology, you realize that from the very first day, the embryo starts dividing in a way that exhibits a coordinated growth, and that is as much an organism as it is later in life. And as I looked at it more, I realized that human life is a continuity from fertilization to natural death, and that we need to honor that life just as we honor life at any stage. That's the safest way to go forward. That's the most moral way to go forward.
Dr. Hurlbut, thanks very much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Dr. William Hurlbut is a consulting professor for the program in human biology at Stanford University. He's also a member of the President's Council on Bioethics. Still to come, a Turkish-born choreographer living and working in the United States finds bitter inspiration after the September 11th terrorist attacks. You're listening to Here and Now. History could be made this weekend at America's most historic automobile race, the Indianapolis 500. It won't be all gentlemen starting their engines for this Sunday's race. For only the fourth time in its history, one of the Indianapolis 500 drivers is a woman. And Danica Patrick has a good shot at taking home the trophy. Bill Littlefield, host of NPR's weekly sports program Only a Game, spoke with Lars Anderson, who writes about auto racing for Sports Illustrated.
Danica Patrick is likely to be one of the stars of this race, but is it fair to say she's the first one with a solid chance to win the race?
Without question. All during this month, she's consistently been among the fastest in practice. She's a very compelling person, and she's very important to what she could mean to the future of this sport. The IRL needs a face of the sport. They need a personality that average fans can latch onto. She's got a wonderful biography. She moved to England by herself at age 16, to race formula cars, and she endured some pretty tough times over there. And she hasn't won a race yet, but race fans all over the world are talking about her. Just a few days ago, Rich O'Brien, who's my editor at Sports Illustrated, he got an email from a guy in India telling Rich that we need to write about Danica in the magazine. So she really has taken the sport by storm this month.
She did drive the fastest lap at Indy during qualifying. Does that give her any sort of psychological advantage?
You bet. She knows that she has a winning car, and that is half the battle. There's probably only about 6-7 guys in the field, including Danica, who have a car that will be quick enough mechanically to win the race, and she certainly has it.
Let's turn to some of the other drivers. Tony Kanaan won the pole position for Sunday's race. That, I presume, is not exactly a surprise. Has any contemporary driver been any more consistent than Kanaan has been over the last year or so?
Absolutely not. In fact, Tony Kanaan, he's my pick to win the race. It's not a sexy pick, but he's been strong all month at Indy, and a win at the 500 would validate the amazing season he had last year. And that's when he became the first driver in any series in the world to complete every lap of every race. He was the ultimate Ironman, and the win at Indy would sort of validate his season last year.
Fans of stories that have been sad and need happy endings may be rooting for Kenny Brack, who won the Indy 500 back in 1999. Brack was injured in a crash less than 2 years ago, and his recovery kept him off the track for a year. What's the likelihood that Brack wins?
I was in Texas at Texas Motor Speedway in October 2003 for the IRL season finale, and that's when Kenny got hurt. And all of us up in the press box just didn't think there was any way he could survive that. His car literally disintegrated. He got up in the air and went into the catch fence and rolled about 25 times in the catch fence and came down, and his car just absolutely shattered. He had multiple injuries, and like you said, it took him about a year and a half to heal, and it would certainly be a very emotional win if Kenny Brack could take the checkered flag on Sunday.
Lars, if you asked people who don't follow auto racing in any of its many manifestations to name one venue of the sport, most of them would probably say Indy. But as you've suggested, among racing fans, NASCAR really has eclipsed open-wheel racing. Do you see that as changing, or is NASCAR simply, too much the big kid to be overcome?
I think NASCAR is too much the big kid to be overcome. The IRL is going to have to cultivate young American drivers to reach their series. You know, more than half of the field is foreign drivers. And, I think that's great, but the typical American fan wants to root for an American driver. And, if Danica Patrick wins the race, I think that will go a long ways towards helping the IRL grow in the future. But NASCAR is just so overwhelmingly popular right now that it's tough to see the IRL ever getting back to the level where it once was in the 60s and 70s, when Indy racing was in the 60s and 70s, when you had guys like A.J. Foyt and Johnny Rutherford that fans all over the country rooted for.
Here comes Speed Racer, he's a demon on wheels. He's a demon and he's gonna be chasing after someone.
Lars Anderson writes about auto racing for SportsIllustrated.com. He spoke with Bill Littlefield, host of NPR's weekly sports program, Only a Game. Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now.
Dangerous work. Your life's eraser.
I'm Deborah Becker. It's Here and Now. Being Muslim in the United States has gotten complicated since the September 11th terrorist attacks. A Turkish-born folk dancer and choreographer is now translating that difficulty into his work. Ahmed Luluji, artistic director of the Massachusetts-based Collage Dance Ensemble, says a bone-chilling encounter with an angry American in Boston's Logan Airport in the days following 9/11 changed him and his art forever. Ahmed Luluji recently spoke with Here and Now's Lynn Menegon about how that experience helped inspire a new piece called Duality.
Duality, to me, right now I'm so emotionally attached to it because this is coming straight from me, from my experience in past few years, actually. As we all know, we went through really hard times in this country after September 11th. It was not a fun time at all. And some people like me, whose background is from Middle East, it was extremely difficult. When September 11 happened, I was in São Paulo, Brazil, teaching. And actually, I was supposed to fly back on September 11. So, of course, what I see, I go to airport, the flights are canceled, I have no idea what's happening. I go back immediately to the hotel and see what's happening. Finally, 5 days later, I took the first flight available back to country. And on the plane, I'm reading the newspapers. And you know, like, I'm an artist. I'm an emotional person. I couldn't stop it, and I was crying with the stories people were telling. It was such a tough situation. So I come back to Boston. At the airport, I'm waiting for my wife to pick me up. And this person with a car stops in front of me and looks at me, and I thought he's going to ask something. He looks at me and says, I said, can I help you? He said, you look like a freaking terrorist. I was like, I was frozen. I'm looking around. I'm like, is he talking to me? So, and then he just goes. To tell the truth, if I wasn't married and if I didn't have my child, you know, I had a feeling like I should go back to Turkey for a few years until everything, you know, it was very difficult. And I am an American. I have an American passport and I feel American and I love this country. So it was so difficult. So anyway, after that, another very, very interesting thing happened. This happened in Turkey. I take my dance company to Turkey, to this dance festival and competition. This was right after, actually, the Iraq war has started. The very first day we arrived at the festival, something happened in Iraq. 11 Turkish soldiers were arrested by American army. And on the media, in Turkish media, actually, what we saw was that they were treated as terrorists. Like they put bags on the Turkish soldiers' heads and everything. We go to perform. We go onto the stage, and first thing you hear is boo. I mean, huge boo. And the funny thing is, half of my group is Turkish, half is American. So my dancers are looking at me, and I'm looking at them. Okay, keep going, keep going. So I came up with an idea, actually. I told them, okay, line up, guys. We're going to do a couple of Turkish numbers on the stage. 5,000 people watching at the festival. We put the Turkish number in music and dead silence. So we did the number towards the end, the middle of the number. They understood actually that we were doing it. You know, we were really like, they're like, are they Turkish? They started clapping and cheering and everything. And then we finished the number. It was like standing ovation. Like, what is going on? Yeah, this is what is the most interesting thing to me. I mean, Turkish people are so emotional that they can flip-flop in a minute. You know what I mean? So all these emotions actually brought me this concept that saying that, you know, I got to put this on stage. Not necessarily meaning that my exact personal experiences, but the feelings, the emotions, I said. I can get really pessimistic and then turn the whole thing around by being very optimistic. You know, I'm never like in the middle of it. You know what I mean? It's always either that or this. So I've been fighting all along to get to the middle points. And these experiences actually, since September 11, did make me find the middle way.
How do you translate that into movement? One thing I notice is you've got groups of men and women opposing each other, sort of not crashing into each other, but sort of pushing each other around.
Mm-hmm, exactly. I start the number with a neutral part, meaning that I have a Mevlevi, we call it, a Sufi person turning. Okay. Have you ever seen World Languages? For those people who are not seeing, it's like one hand is facing, one palm is facing down to the earth. the other hand, palm is facing to the sky, to the God, and the head is shifted to the right and turning around himself. Actually, it's amazingly difficult. These people are turning like 45 minutes an hour, 2 hours without getting dizzy. So they play this specific music for their practice. But it's also used in the modern Turkey. It's also used just for listening, like kind of like almost like a, how can I say this? Like to calm yourself. And then we go into second part. We go into this canopy dance, I call it. Three optimists are coming with scarves on their hands. So they're making all these elegant, nice, feminine movements.
With long scarves, long scarves that are about, I don't know, 10 feet long.
And then right after that, I bring the percussion. It sounds African, it sounds Turkish, it sounds Middle Eastern, it sounds Eastern European, it sounds Japanese in a way. It's so interesting. And in the middle of that section, actually, they bring a traditional touch to it from Turkey, which is actually the command to the dancers what to do. It sounds like screaming, which kind of works. And the movements are very powerful, lots of jumps and drops and everything. And the music is like real, like almost like somebody's pushing a pin on your skin in a way. And in the middle of this section, I bring the optimistic side of the girls, optimistic side of the choreography in again. And they are kind of like struggling. They're fighting with the pessimism. You know, it's almost like going back and forth.
How does it end?
In the end, this was a very, very tough decision for me. I kept saying that, who's going to win? And then I said to myself, why should somebody win? So the way we finish is, actually, the very first movement of Mevlevi comes in. And we all actually, in a way, we not exactly squat, but bend the bodies over towards each other, facing each other, and kind of like accepting each other. One accepting the other. Both emotions are saying that, you know what? We are twin brothers, we are twin sisters. It's a very sensitive period we are living. You know, there's war, the emotions are very high. It's everything is on the very, very thin string, you know. It's a very tough situation. So we need more connection between people, we feel like. And I'm doing my part by uniting people through my numbers, through you know, like holding people's hands or whatever it may take. When I choreograph something, I try to unify everybody.
Ahmet Luluji, Artistic Director of the Collage Dance Ensemble, spoke with Here and Now's Lynn Menegon. For more information about his company, go to our website, here-now.org. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. Join us again, Here and Now. For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.